So our Lobby Day 2015, Raising Our Voices, is coming 2 weeks from today, April 23rd. We're really pleased that you'll be participating, and we're very lucky to have three very knowledgeable people and stalwart NELA members to do this issues training today. So how we're going to do this is that Cliff Pilewski from San Francisco is our expert on the Arbitration Fairness Act, and he's going to speak first. Then Jonathan Puth, whose office is around the corner from mine in D.C., is our expert on the Civil Justice Tax Fairness Act. And then Megan O'Malley from Chicago is the co-chair of NELA's Judicial Nominations Committee, and she's going to talk about lobbying on judicial nominations. And you all have the link to the materials on the email that you received today, and you'll have hard copies of these materials on Lobby Day itself. So I'm going to give each speaker about 15 minutes to speak, and then turn to the next person, and then we will take questions on any subject at the end. So, Cliff, if you want to get us started, please.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, hi, everybody. Thank you. We've done a lot of lobbying over the years on the issue, and I just want to share some thoughts and themes. There's not going to be, I don't think there's going to be an actual bill that's going to be introduced and that we need to really focus on so much is the concept. The AFA, as it has been introduced in prior Congresses, extended not only to employment claims and consumer claims, but to civil rights claims, and in the most recent version added antitrust claims. And the truth of the matter is it's gotten very large, has enormous opposition, and with a Republican Congress, the chances of moving an actual bill is slim. But what's really, really important is to talk to Congress folks and get them focused on the issue of mandatory versus voluntary arbitration, and especially on the distinction between employment claims as opposed to some of the other claims. For instance, consumer claims clearly have an imbalance in power. Antitrust claims sometimes do. But every time we've gone up to the Hill, people have recognized the distinction between civil rights, sex harassment, sex discrimination claims, and other kinds of claims like banking claims and credit card claims. And I think we really need to stay focused on the distinction between employment. One of the things that we find is that a lot of Congress people are very concerned about what they would call a trial lawyer bill, or bills that would serve the interests of trial lawyers or create excessive litigation. So the most important thing to convey is that we at NELA support and encourage all voluntary forms of ADR. And in fact, ADR really serves our clients' interests, especially in the employment area. And that in order for ADR to be successful, it has to have the confidence of its users, and it has to be perceived as fair and be fair in fact. And there are certain things that are simply inarguable. One is that the people who love and cherish the institutions of arbitration and ADR generally all recognize that it really has to be voluntary to be perceived as fair. And the mere act of mandating it on somebody, allowing one party to create the system, choose the arbitrators, and force it on the other right from the get-go is inconsistent with the perception of fairness that's necessary for it to succeed. So voluntary ADR or prohibiting mandatory actually is very supportive of the concept of ADR. We completely support post-dispute ADR of every sort. We think mediation is a phenomenal way to resolve employment cases. Some of the problems with mandatory ADR that are just inarguable are the costs. It's obviously essentially free to go to court. In some states, they require the employer to pay, but that's not universal. So the costs and the filing fees can be as high as $15,000 just to get in the door. Arbitrators charge sometimes $400, $500 per arbitrator. The cost can be in the tens of thousands of dollars. We lecture the world on the importance of the rule of law, and arbitrators are not required to know or follow the law. These are, in every respect, secret tribunals with no right of appeal, that statistics have demonstrated a profound repeat player advantage, where the repeat company who hires the lawyers, hires the arbitrators, they win more often, they pay less when they lose, and there are even structural limitations, such as the limitations on discovery, that when you're trying to prove a discrimination case, for instance, you're trying to prove someone's state of mind, and the employer has access to all of the witnesses, all of the documents, and you really can't succeed in those cases without adequate discovery. And another point, which maybe will come through, is recently we had the big Ellen Powell trial, and even though she lost, the debate that was created about the subtle forms of gender discrimination has been fantastic. And my primary comment after the case was that the debate will do more to change the way people conduct themselves, that there is a significant deterrent effect to public trials. And one public verdict, one public trial, even like the Powell case where she lost, will do more to change the workplace than 100 private arbitrations. It's also a really effective theme to make it clear that Congress has passed certain employment laws because they were necessary, and the people they are regulating have simply opted out of the law, required people to waive the right to enforce the law as a condition of employment. And to sort of challenge them to give substance to their own acts of Congress. Another thing, which is really helpful, is that the agencies charged with enforcing the laws, the EEOC, still has on its books a unanimous policy statement saying that mandatory arbitration undermines their ability to enforce the law. The Department of Labor as opposed to mandatory arbitration or forced arbitration many times in many contexts. The NLRB has said repeatedly that prohibitions on class actions and joinder of claims, even in the non-unionized workforce, violates the labor laws. I had sent to Laura, I don't know if it got around, a target. When I was lobbying at the NLRB and talking about this, I found it very effective to make one big point, because it used to be that arbitration simply meant you went to arbitration. It didn't preclude class actions. Now we know that an arbitration agreement does not allow class actions and probably not even joinder or consolidation. One of the most fundamental underlying tenets of American labor law is the right to have someone represent you, because the reality is you can't challenge your present employer for wage and hour issues, for discrimination issues, without fearing retaliation. And that means that as opposed to, there are four federal statutes, the ADEA, the Equal Pay Act, the FLSA, and the FMLA. Every single one of those statutes specifically says in the text of the statute that you can file on your own behalf or on behalf of others similarly situated. And they say that because of the recognition that it simply isn't practical to try to sue your present employer without being retaliated against. So I've created this target, and I just hold it up, because what they're basically saying is that by requiring each individual to sue on their own, they are asking you to put a target on your chest. And it is the fact that every single employment statute has a retaliation provision, because it's a real and concerning factor. It's also important to point out that the Republicans have passed numerous laws prohibiting mandatory arbitration to protect their constituents. They passed a bill prohibiting mandatory arbitration of car dealer disputes with the auto manufacturers. It passed the House literally unanimously. They passed a farm bill that prohibits mandatory arbitration of farm contracts. We've also passed legislation prohibiting mandatory arbitration of military payday loans. So it's sort of silly to suggest that car dealers need protection, but victims of discrimination, of sex harassment, of civil rights violations, of wage and hour violations aren't entitled to the same protection. Congress has also passed the Franken Amendment, which prohibits any company getting more than $1 million from the Defense Department from requiring arbitration of Title VII or sex abuse cases. And President Obama recently extended that by executive order to any federal contractor. So that's already out there, and it seems to be working very well, and the world has not come to an end. One of the things that's really important to make clear is that the Supreme Court has said that unless Congress says that mandatory arbitration is prohibited, that we're going to presume that Congress intends it to be okay. Now, we know that that's a fantasy because most of the laws were passed before they came down with this ruling. But because the Supreme Court has said, Congress, you must say what you mean, it's very important that going forward, if there's going to be a discussion of ENDA, for instance, it's still remarkable that we don't have a federal bill protecting sexual orientation. That's going to go forward. The Fair Pay Act is going to go forward. The Paycheck Fairness Act is going to go forward. And it's really critical that people who say they support those bills, which are pretty essential Democratic high priorities, need to understand that those bills have to say something that makes it clear that voluntary arbitration is okay, but mandatory arbitration is not. The statistics, we have statistics as a result of an examination of all of the AAA's caseload that shows dramatically that discrimination cases do very, very poorly in arbitration. One of the things I explain to people is that it's easy for an arbitrator to say, I think this is fair or that's fair, but it takes a lot more for them to put their name on an award of discrimination, to accuse someone of discrimination, where the award would then require a large award of attorney's fees and potential punitive damages. And we've now documented statistically that civil rights cases in particular fare very, very poorly, so that the laws are simply not being enforced. We also have the USERRA bill coming up, which was fairly easy to lobby on at the time. USERRA is a bill that protects returning or serving service people, and it's very effective, you know, to make the point that these people go abroad, and when they come home, even though Congress has passed a law that says on its face that you may not require any contract that waives any rights or procedures, that the courts are compelling these soldiers to go to secret tribunals with no right of appeal to protect the rights granted by Congress. One of the probably most compelling arguments is that states have traditionally regulated the employment relationship, and almost every state has a state agency charged with enforcing the wage and hour laws of their state. Someplace workers can go to get their paychecks, to get their overtime, separate from the Department of Labor. And in many states, like California and others, have civil rights agencies. As the law stands right now, if an employer mandates an arbitration clause, those state agencies don't have jurisdiction over these claims. So an employer can literally opt out of any state's authority to provide an inexpensive forum to enforce wage and hour laws, discrimination laws. And what's so ironic is that these agencies were set up as a device to help resolve cases without litigation in a cheaper way for people who don't have representation. And the notion that these state agencies wholesale are losing their jurisdiction simply because an employer is requiring it as a condition of employment is really unconscionable. And these themes obviously play well to Democrats. Our biggest weakness here is we can't find Republicans to join and co-sponsor any of these bills because the Chamber of Commerce has made it a top priority. So our focus really needs to be on educating people that prohibiting mandatory arbitration is actually very pro-ADR, that we encourage it, we want to use it, but all of the mechanisms that have been set up to help resolve claims properly are being undermined, and you simply can't let those being regulated opt out of the regulation. I think I used up my 15 minutes there.
Yep, I think you're just at the at 15 minutes. So thank you very, very much, and we will go on to Jonathan. Oh, Cliff, but I guess before I – do you well, maybe I can provide it at the afterward by email if people want to talk with you or ask a question with you. I can send
contact. I'm available to anybody anytime.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, Jonathan, without further ado, go ahead and then.
Thanks. Thanks, Laura. I'm Jonathan Puth. Laura and I were just on Capitol Hill this morning meeting with Senator Cardin's office about the reintroduction of the Civil Justice Tax Fairness Act. The CJTFA would address a change in the law that took place in 1996 when Congress, in its wisdom at that time, it was under Speaker Gingrich, and in addition to shutting down the government, they also had the wisdom of passing the Small Business Job Protection Act, which made taxable all awards and settlements to in employment discrimination cases. And this is significantly different than, as many people are aware, of torts case, a slip and fall, anything in which any award is not taxable in the least, even wages. And this created a huge problem, and so in terms of making settlements more expensive and really creating hugely unjust results for individual litigants. And so in shortly thereafter, in bipartisan fashion, were introduced what had been known by a variety of other names, including the Civil Rights Tax Fairness Act, which had three provisions. One dealt with attorney's fees, and so that attorney's fees would only be taxable to the attorney and not to the client who never received them. And the other two provisions were to exempt from taxation the non-economic, non-punitive damages, that is for emotional damages, and additionally for back pay and front pay to allow for income averaging, so that large amounts of back pay and front pay that might otherwise place somebody in a higher tax bracket could be averaged through a simple formula, and that additional tax burden would not be felt. In 2004, through the hard work of NELA and a lot of great work by my former partner Bruce Fredrickson, Congress passed a law to deal with probably the most onerous and most significant of the tax burdens, and that it provided for an above-the-line deduction for individuals to deduct their attorney's fees. So as we all know, or most of us know, if we're litigators, that we that those attorney's fees may be reported by our clients, or should be reported by our clients as income, but then the attorney's fees are immediately deductible as an above-the-line deduction. And so that hardship was alleviated, but it left the other two. And so in any event, the The bill has been introduced year after year, as with the Arbitration Fairness Act, which, by the way, I spoke with Senator Franken a couple of weeks ago, and he's very excited about reintroducing the Arbitration Fairness Act. So we just have to go in and let him know how much we support it and how much we look forward to his introducing it. I think we'll be able to prompt him to do so without much trouble. But in any event, the Civil Justice Tax Fairness Act is in the same position. It has been the 2013 version was introduced by Senator Cardin along with Republican Susan Collins of Maine as the prime co-sponsor. We have always worked to push the bipartisan nature of this legislation. It's been introduced by John Lewis in the House with another Democrat and two Republican members, I believe Aaron Schock and James Sensenbrenner, who's a pretty heavy hitter, been around a long time. And so we hope that Congressman Lewis will also be interested in reintroducing the bill. It may not be reintroduced by the time of our April 23rd lobby day, but I think it's safe to say that it will be reintroduced. And it's an important issue for many good reasons. One of the reasons for which the attorney's fees portion passed, the entire bill had the support of the Chamber of Commerce because it was just making it obviously more expensive to try and settle cases if more of it was subject to taxation. And so the chamber stepped in and went down there and lobbied, and we got the bill attached to another vehicle, and unfortunately only one third of it was passed, but it was a pretty darn good one. But the same concept applies. We do have business-oriented organizations that have supported this. There's an association, a general counsel. I forget exactly what their name is, but I believe it's on some of the fact sheets in your packages, and I know it's on the NELA website as well regarding the Civil Justice Tax Fairness Act, that it simply helps to reduce the cost of litigation, makes it more likely that cases will settle, and to avoid expensive trials and that burden on the system as well. So the strategy is probably very much the same as the Arbitration Fairness Act. We do have an easier time attracting Democrats to the bill. For probably the same reason that these damages became taxable and to begin with, and that some folks have the idea that civil rights litigants that maybe employment discrimination doesn't even exist. So I think that we have a much more ready audience with some members, but we are able to boast some bipartisanship. It is not likely that we're going to be able to pass this immediately, but we have to maintain that presence. We have to have the bill ready because the appropriate vehicle for legislation like this could come along at any time. Now, one thing that I wanted that members will be very interested in is, well, what's the cost? What's the score, as they call it? The Joint Committee on Taxation comes up with a score on tax legislation. What is it going to cost? And they haven't scored this bill since 2004. So we would really like to, or since before the 2004 legislation passed, the attorney's fees portion, when it had that attorney's fees portion, which I have to believe is the most impact on the U.S. Treasury from among these, it was $632 million over 10 years. We would really like for them to get the bill rescored. So if you're talking with anybody who is a member of either of the tax committees, that request to get the bill rescored would be really important. But first of all, they're going to want to know, well, what's the score? And it is $632 million over 10 years. And you'll be able to tell them, you know, realistically, it's a much smaller number than that. So we are asking our sponsors is to go back to the Joint Committee on Taxation and look up how it was scored in 2004, and hopefully be able to calculate from there. That'll be a much, much, much smaller number. It's not going to be a huge tax impact, revenue impact. What else? One thing that came up this morning that I thought of, you know, that is. That you know, we already allocate our settlements and court awards as well are allocated by back pay, front pay, by non-economic damages, by attorney's fees. It's something that we're very used to doing as employment attorneys now, to 1099 certain income and to W-2 certain income. The one very important thing about the legislation is, first of all, it's not going to change the taxation of wages. While if you have a slip and fall or you get hit by a bus and you miss work, you can recover wages and get those tax-free in those cases. We're not asking that that's the case in this legislation. This is still going to tax people for back pay, for front pay. It's a modest proposal here. Also, explicitly, this bill does not affect the taxation of punitive damages in employment cases. So punitive damages, although very rare, will continue to be taxed in all employment cases. What types of cases does it affect? Well, the legislation itself, and you can see it from your materials, affects what they call discrimination cases, and then it cross-references to another section of the code. That section of the code is the one that had passed in 2004, and it's a long, 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 long list. And the good thing is that it is really just about every kind of case you can imagine that we do. Any employment case, a severance negotiation, a pregnancy case, a USERRA case, FLSA case, a contract negotiation, that latter one, I'd have to check the statute, but I'm telling you, it's maybe a breach of contract. Breach of contract, that would be on the list. But in any event, the other thing I just wanted to mention is the effect on USERRA, and as with Cliff, I think USERRA provides a good example that many members of Congress and their staffs can relate to as a statute that is non-controversial and that has always drawn great support from Congress across the board. USERRA cases deal with lost wages, really, lost wages and benefits. It's a very, very broad statute. In fact, if you're working on any USERRA case, let me send you a brief that I recently did on lost wages and benefits, because they are subject, I am convinced, to liquidated damages, whether it's front pay, back pay, or anything, and it should all be determinable by a jury. That's a total aside, but I want to let you know that. But in any event, USERRA cases can involve many years of back pay and front pay, and that's where probably your best example is for the issue of income averaging. I would suggest that it's a statute that people respect like the flag, and you want to use that to get behind as a good example. I think that covers most of my points. Just to sum up, really, there are two two parts to this legislation. The reason I brought up the third part was because of that issue involving the score. Everyone wants to know the score. You'll find that when you go on Capitol Hill. But it's something much, much less than $632 million over 10 years that this is going to exempt emotional damages, and it's going to provide for income averaging. You don't have to go back and amend tax returns or anything like that. There's a simple formula. It's in the bill. You can read it and probably even understand it pretty readily after reading it, and the legislation is in the materials. Okay, thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Okay, and next and last for today, we have Megan O'Malley, who's from Chicago, and Megan is the co-chair of NELA's Judicial Nominations Committee, so she's going to talk about our lobbying and work on judicial nominations. Go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Laura, and
yeah, thank
I'm
you.
Going to try to keep it brief. I know we're all busy. And my issue only relates to the U.S. Senate visits. It is only your United States senators that weigh in on judicial federal judicial nominations, not your congresspersons. So keep that in mind as you're going to your Hill visits, and that will probably be readily apparent in the Leave Behind packets that you will get that will not have judicial noms information in the Congress packets. At any rate, I want to briefly just, I know some of you probably already know this, but I don't believe it's as intuitive as people think or as widely publicized, how the process actually works. I think everybody knows that the senators have the advise and consent role and have to vote on judicial noms, but I just want to briefly go over the procedure so that you kind of have an understanding. I think it's helpful when you're talking to the Senate staff that when they use buzzwords and lingo that you seem to understand it. So when there's a vacancy in federal court, the vacancy is usually announced by the senators in that state. The senators in that state are sort of primarily responsible, at least with regard to district court nominees, to select the candidates for that vacancy. And some state senators work together on that, particularly if they're in the same party. Other times they do that separately, and usually if they're in different parties, although sometimes they do work together and cross parties. Here in Illinois, the way it works is that Senator Durbin has a commission and Senator Kirk has a commission. That Durbin is Democrat and Kirk is Republican. And they have they call it a gentleman's agreement to whoever's party is in presidential office gets to choose the judicial noms on a 3-to-1 basis. So for every 3 that Durbin chooses because a Democrat's in office now, then he turns it over to Kirk to choose the 4th, and then they start over. Some other states work like that, and this is all state dependent. The circuit court nominees, the White House has a little bit more control or involvement in. However, they do often, again, leave that to the senators to do an initial nomination of these candidates. So what happens, your senator may have a screening committee like mine do, or they may not. They may do it themselves. One of the things we're going to ask of you all on your Senate visits when you talk about judicial noms is to actually ask that question. The Judicial Nominations Committee is putting together a state-by-state survey because we do want to see how it's done in each state, because the reason that matters is we have often been told in talks with the White House and in talks with our senators that in order to get a more professionally diverse bench, they want to see more professionally diverse candidates come forward and apply for these vacancies, which they don't always see. And one of the ways to is not only to encourage people to apply, but then also to know how the process works so that we can get involved in that process earlier rather than once the nominees have been named. At any rate, so if you could, during your Senate visits, ask your Senate staff, how does Senator so-and-so do this? Does he have a commission, yes or no? How does he, choose people for his commission? you know, can you share with me the makeup of the commission? And then how does he, do they take turns? Do they work together? Do they have a joint commission? Does it depend on which presidential, you know, which party's in office for a president? So those are the things that, you know, we'd like you to ask as part of the process of talking about judicial nominations with your senators. The senators then, once you, so in states that employ like a screening committee, they will whittle it down to, you know, maybe 5 to 10 candidates. The screening committee will do first and second round interviews potentially. And then the remaining finalists will meet with the senator, who then selects. Sometimes, you know, here in Illinois, Senator Kirk tends to select one name for his one vacancy, which puts the White House in the awkward position of either saying yes or no, and they usually, well, historically have always said, okay, we'll go with that person. Senator Durbin, on the other hand, usually gives the White House, let's say he'll give them 5 names for 2 vacancies. And then, so the White House will then select from those. So now we have the White House is the one that actually is the president's actually the one who nominates, who officially nominates these people. Then these nominees will go to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Before they can get a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee, both senators have to return what's called a blue slip. And this is not a formal Senate rule. It's actually more of a practice that has been adopted and has been respected on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I hate this practice. I think it should be it shouldn't exist, because it allows people, what it does is it's literally a blue slip. Your senator has to say, the home state senator of the nominee has to say, yes, I approve of this person enough to literally allow them to go forward with a Senate Judiciary Committee vote. And so if a senator says, no, I don't like this person, you know, so here in Illinois, for example, we have a Democrat and a Republican. If Senator Durbin chooses somebody who Senator Kirk thinks is too progressive, all Senator Kirk has to do is say, I'm not going to return the blue slip. And then that person never even gets a Senate Judiciary Committee committee vote. There's been an awful lot of abuse of the blue slip process, where people don't return these blue slips for highly qualified candidates who, you know, just because they don't want to see somebody who they think isn't very, very conservative or aligned with their politics and on the bench. And that'll be part of, that becomes important, because that'll be part of what we're going to ask them to encourage to not abuse the blue slip process. That's one way of delaying the votes on these nominees. If both blue slips are returned, the Judiciary Committee will then schedule a hearing, and the nominee will come forward and answer questions of the Judiciary Committee, who will then vote on whether or not this person goes on to the next step. You know, it's typically referred to as being voted out of committee, and that is then being voted. If the majority of the Senate Judiciary Committee says that they approve of this person to be voted out of committee, then they get a full Senate vote. And then the filibuster rule was changed a year or two ago so that we can no longer, the Senate can no longer filibuster these judicial nominees and have to, so it's a simple majority now, which is a good thing, although maybe not since the Senate changed power. But only once they're voted out of committee can they get a Senate floor vote, and that's just a straight up or down, yes, I approve of this person, no, I don't. Historically, what happened in Obama's early presidency and in other administrations when the Senate wants to play politics with judicial noms is they just don't give them a vote. They never schedule it for a vote. They don't vote them out of committee. They hold up blue slips. There's all kinds of ways of delaying these things. And then the problem becomes what is frustrating, particularly frustrating, is where the Republicans might block votes on, you know, a dozen candidates or all of them. What you find later is when these people finally get their votes, they're almost unanimously voted confirmed. These are not ideology objections. it is literally playing politics and just saying we're not going to fill these seats, period, until and unless, you know, maybe we want X, Y, or Z from you in order to hold these votes. It may be we don't want to advance these because we don't want President Obama to have more judicial noms than we think President Bush had or something like that. But it's when they end up getting their vote, these are all highly qualified people, and they don't really garner, it's very rare for them to get something other than a 96-0 or a 97-2 at any rate. So That's how the process works, and I wanted to explain that because sometimes when you're sitting in these meetings, your person will say, well, yeah, but we have the blue slip problem. And I remember, you know, when I first started doing this, I was like, what the hell is a blue slip? And I don't want to ask, you know, and sound like I don't know, I can't maintain that dialogue with them. So the purpose of the judicial nominations visits with the Senate on this lobby day is going to be twofold. Number one, well, threefold. Number one, I did ask already if you guys could please ask your senators how their process works. That would be number one. Number two, NELA has always had a focus on diversifying the bench, both with regard to traditional diversity, but more recently the focus has shifted to professional diversity. President Obama has done a fantastic job on traditional diversity. We have a much more diverse bench than we have ever had in the history of the federal courts. He's had a lot of firsts, a lot of, you know, openly gay and lesbian in districts that have never seen that, Native American. He's had his numbers on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, even disability have been fantastic. So we don't need to necessarily push that more than because they will be able to show that traditional diversity has done very well under Obama. What still has not done very well under Obama or any of his predecessors in recent times is professional background diversity. And this is something we've been lobbying the White House and Congress and our senators on for a number of years. And NELA did a study on the importance of professional background diversity to enforcing workers' rights and said when we have a bench that isn't professionally diverse, that is detrimental to workers' rights. And that's only intuitive. So what the trend is nationwide is really a lot of federal prosecutors. A lot of federal prosecutors. I think sometimes Republican senators think that they're tough on crime, and they you know say, oh, these people are tough on crime, and you know it's not really their job once they're a judge to be the prosecutor anymore, so it doesn't even really make sense. But they like to pull the ranks, pull these judges from prosecutor ranks.
So even, Megan, I'm going to just ask you to wrap up.
Sure.
We have a little time for questions.
Okay. So then the other thing is prosecutors who go to big firms representing corporate defendants. So what, you know, we've always explained is you wouldn't, just as the Chamber of Commerce might have a complete heart attack if, you know, the federal bench were full of plaintiff's lawyers or, you know, trial lawyers, you know, everybody would understand. No, of course, that would be unbalanced. You wouldn't want all plaintiffs' trial lawyers to be on the federal bench. But the flip side of that is true, too. So, you know, whenever we do these conversations with the Senate staff, we just ask them to, you know, please keep in mind that, you know, we're just asking for balance. We're not asking for all plaintiffs' lawyers, but we do ask you to keep in mind that, you know, we do need balance. We need balanced perspectives on the bench because these rights that are being enforced in the federal courts for individuals are very, very important. Clean air, clean water, consumer protection, civil rights. And we should have balanced perspective, which means that we shouldn't just have corporate defense and prosecutors. So that's a second ask that we will ask of you to make to your senators. And then the real acute pressing concern right now is sadly that since the Republican leadership has taken over with the most recent election, they have refused to move any nominations to vote, period. So now we're going to see increased vacancies, increased delays. In 2015, the Senate hasn't confirmed a single judge. You'll get the talking points. Please review them. They're very helpful. The statistics are in here about the increase in vacancies since the Senate Republicans took over. I won't read them to you since we're short on time, but the, you know, Senate's mandate, they have a constitutional mandate to confirm these people. And not to play politics with them. And historically, so you know, when you're talking with your Senate staff, I would say, you know, read the talking points yourself so you're familiar with them. You know, you're going to identify the problem for them. Justice delayed is justice denied. These vacancies are increasing. There's longer waits for justice. It disincentivizes good candidates to even put their name in the hat when they have to wait for years and be in limbo about, you know, are they going to be a judge or not. Identify the solution. Move the nomination. Support a vote. Support qualified nominees without regard to partisan politics. But literally just support the up or down vote. Move these candidates. And don't play politics with things like blue slips. And then, you know, you're going to have some precedential things to be able to tell them that historically the Senate has worked in a bipartisan manner to confirm judicial nominees in the final 2 years of a president's term, even when a different party controlled the Senate, and including in the last 2 years of President George W. Bush's term, 68 circuit and district court judges were confirmed. Again, these numbers are in your talking points, but you'll be able to identify that, you know, this is historically the Democrats didn't block, you know, Bush's nominees. We're asking that, you know, President Obama's last 2 years of office cannot be a 2 years of we're not going to move judicial noms. It's critical that we do to fill vacancies. The courts are already understaffed, and the courts, in fact, recently asked for more judiciary seats to be created, because even at full capacity, assuming all the seats that are vacant were filled, the Office of the United States Courts said we're still understaffed, we're still, you know, over-docketed. So these are important points to make to your Senate staff, to ask them to move the nominees, fill the vacancies, don't play politics with them, and fill them with highly qualified but professionally diverse people.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you to all three of you. We haven't invented a phone version of applause, but I'm applauding the three of you. I want to be mindful of the time, so we are just about at the end of the time. I think let's do, I don't know if the speakers can stay on any longer. I want people to feel free to get off the call at any point that you need to get off, but if people have questions, let's hear them, and you can stay on for, you know, we'll stay on the call for a few more minutes to take the questions. Anyone with a question?
Yes, this is John Gould.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question for Cliff, if he's still here.
I'm here. Hey, John.
Hi, Cliff, how are you? I haven't heard any groundswell in the press about any of these issues on AFA in a long time. I know we had that film that Robert Reich narrated about a year and a half ago that was widely distributed. Any attempts to get some kind of press to get more interested in this issue? And
yeah.
If so, how are you doing with that?
Yeah,
because I don't see this going anywhere without some kind of churning in the public.
Right.
Public,
well, we're not going to do very much in Congress. There's actually been a lot of noise lately because the Consumer Financial Products Bureau was given a charge by Congress in the Dodd-Frank legislation to study, and then if they deem it appropriate, to prohibit forced arbitration in matters under their jurisdiction. And they took their time and they did exhaustive studies, and they came out with a phenomenal report a few weeks ago that got widespread publicity. It got picked up everywhere. And we're expecting that in the next few weeks they may actually propose regulations that will prohibit mandatory arbitration. And that's been a gigantic hook for the story. So that's where it's been. And there's actually a pretty dynamic coalition, the Fair Arbitration Now Coalition. That's probably got 40 or 50 different organizations supporting it. So I think that's where all the noise has been. And it's been pretty effective. There's also been some grassroots uprisings that, you know, Neela was involved in when the cereal companies, you know, I forget which one it was, Cheerios or something, tried to put mandatory arbitration clauses in if you check out their website or get a rebate. And the coalition is presently going after Spotify, who's trying to insert a mandatory arbitration clause. So there's a lot going on, not as much in the employment world, as there is waiting for the Consumer Financial Products Bureau to issue their regulations, because it should be pretty easy to tag onto that publicity-wise.
Great. Thank you. Thanks. We also recently have been in contact with, with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal who covers employment exclusively, and she's very, very interested in this. She's done one piece, but I think she's interested in doing more. So I agree. We need to get these issues in people's minds and people thinking about what this means to them.
Laura, can I follow up on that? One of the real big problems we've had in NELA is getting the civil rights community to make this a priority. For some reason, they don't seem to grasp how important it is. They seem focused on minor fixes to various pieces of legislation, and we've never been able to get them, for instance, to include a prohibition in the Paycheck Fairness Act or in ENDA or in the gross fix. Truthfully, if we can't get the civil rights community to go front and center, because it can't be a trial or a bill, we're doomed. So if you have connections with the leadership conference or with the women's groups or with the disability groups, they really need to step up and understand that no law means anything if you can't enforce it.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Going once on any of the topics? All right. Then I think we'll wrap up. Thank you again to all three of you very much. Thank you to all of you who joined this call, for taking the time to get on the call, and also for registering, and thank you in advance for coming to Lobby Day. I'm really looking forward to meeting you all and working with you. We will provide a training at the exact same time a week from today on how to lobby. Diane King, who's the NELA Vice President for Public Policy, and I will do that training, which will provide a lot of the logistical details, a quick summary of the materials that you will have received, and some practical tips about conducting your meetings on the Hill. I will circulate with the presenter's permission contact information for you all if people want to reach out about specific issues, and you have my contact information on lots of email that you've gotten from me, both phone and email. I'm happy to hear from any of you. So, I think that's all for today, and thank you again for joining us.